Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of The Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. I'm your host, Brian J. Rowan, and with me, as always, are my cohorts. There's Danny King, a writer for The Film Stage.
Hey, Brian, how's it going?
It's going all right. And also Nick Newman, associate editor for The Film Stage.
Counselor.
You just have a thing for doing Javier Bardem voices.
It's the one impersonation I can actually do.
It's true.
You do pretty well.
Unlike Danny, who's a chameleon when it comes to doing voices. Oh, man. We also have a special guest today. By special request, we received an email on Saturday from someone who is like, I just saw The Counselor. I need to be on the podcast. Another writer for The Film Stage, Danny Mecca.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing all right. Doing all right. Glad to have you here. Interested to see why you made a special request.
Yeah, no, I got stuff to say.
This happens only rarely still does it actually work out that we can record with the person.
Yeah, I'm glad it worked out. I'm happy to be here. Brian, question, what is the J stand for?
James.
All right, nice, cool. Yeah.
I guess that's a one Film Stage Show mystery taken care of.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
Anyway. Guys, that's my time. I'll see you later.
that's all.
Closing this case.
Boom. Everything else was a ruse just to get here to ask me that on the air. So today we will be talking about the newest film by Ridley Scott, written by Cormac McCarthy, my favorite living author, The Counselor, which stars Michael Fassbender, Penelope Cruz, Javier Bardem, Cameron Diaz, and Brad Pitt. Before we get into that, we're going to be talking briefly about our feelings about Ridley Scott, because this is one of the most, I would say, one of the most wildly inconsistent directors working today. But before we get into that, a couple of quick things. Thanks to everyone who's left us comments and ratings on iTunes. If you haven't done that yet, head on over there and do it. You know, we'll respond in kind if we feel that the comment or rating deserves a response or requires a response. Also, if you'd like to get in touch with us, you can get in touch via email at podcast@thefilmstage.com. And as always, you can comment on the actual posts. If you're listening to these on The Film Stage, down there, you just have to have a discuss profile, and you can engage us in a riveting dialogue about the films that we're talking about. That's about it. So let's get into the show proper. Let's talk about Ridley Scott, guys. Sir Ridley Scott, a prolific director. What are our thoughts on him? I kind of want to pose this question this way. When you hear that Ridley Scott has a new film coming out, what do you think? Like, are you happy? Like, you know, is it as if you hear Martin Scorsese's got a new film, or are you meeting it with trepidation, or are you kind of ambivalent? So, Nick Newman, when you hear a new film by Ridley Scott, what thoughts go through your head?
In terms of some kind of qualification, I would say I'm always positively ambivalent. Because I actually do enjoy Ridley Scott's filmography, mostly. If you look at some of his recent movies, admittedly, it's strange how he actually seems to have ballooned in terms of productivity in the 21st century, directing almost as many films as he had his entire career prior, from Gladiator to The Counselor now. And he's currently in production on his Moses epic Exodus, starring Christian Bale, which that latter note to me speaks volumes about him as a filmmaker now, where if you look at his earlier work, you can find a bit of consistency, even if it's minor, you can find a bit of consistency with his work. But lately it's been really strange. You know, he made Black Hawk Down and then Matchstick Men. If you've seen those two films, you would not think they were from the same director. A Good Year, American Gangster, Prometheus, and then after that, The Counselor. After that, the aforementioned Exodus.
You're not even talking, yeah, and also Body of Lies and
Robin Hood
too.
Yeah, Hannibal. Yeah. That's right, and Robin Hood too. Like he really goes all over. And what I had said, I had reviewed The Counselor for The Film Stage. What I said is that it's pretty much impossible to find much of a through line in his work outside of the occasional historical epic. And mostly what I said was that if you really need to find something, it's that he doesn't seem to have a world of concern for screenplays or narratives or things like that. He seems to just want to direct and make movies, which I kind of like. And although it does lead to duds along the way, as such as Robin Hood or, you know, I mean, I guess Hannibal is fascinating, even though it's also very problematic. I guess I think to myself, well, it's kind of neat that he has taken all this work up for himself and keeps going and keeps going and keeps going, seemingly with little pause. You know, you think to yourself, you look at his, he's a guy who signs so many projects, and you look right now, he has, what is it? He has, like, The Future War, which is a sci-fi epic. He has Blade Runner 2. He has Prometheus 2. He has Exodus, this thing. There's something else about, like, an apocalypse happening in England or whatever that he signed on for. So all these films that he's taking on, and you think to yourself, will he ever actually get them done? And although he is actually now, he's about to be 76 in about a month's time, you could see him working for a while because he doesn't seem to be slowing down or losing energy. In fact, he's only accelerating, which I give him credit for, although I do think that when I hear there's a new Ridley Scott movie, I think, oh, I'll go see that. But I'm not head over heels elated at the prospect. I think to myself, well, this will probably look good, at least. But past that, I'm kind of sort of a catch as catch can deal with him in terms of quality.
All right, Danny King, what about yourself?
Well, you know, when I hear there's a new Ridley Scott film being made, I'm happy that he's working. You know, in this economy, that's number one.
just as a human concern, yeah, no, it's good to know that the employment is up.
Good that he's paying the bills. And I would agree that, Nick, that I tend to be positive leaning in terms of his ability to sort of shift subject matters and kind of direct whatever comes his way. Because while that quality might not lend him to easy, clear auteur readings, I think it's kind of fun, and it actually makes his movies fun to look forward to. But I wanted to ask Nick about his comment about him not really caring about screenplays and like what that means exactly. Like, do you think he doesn't care about scripts, or he just doesn't have like a specific kind of subject that he goes after?
I think that he doesn't care to have any narrative input.
I think both are true.
Yeah.
It's just that the whole idea of him kind of not really seeming concerned with a screenplay's content is more prevalent than ever, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. Because I know, like, Thelma and Louise is pretty famous for its script. And other movies I think of his, like American Gangster, which is, you know, very well directed, but, like, I also love that film for, like, the performances and a lot of the dialogue. And obviously The Counselor is wall-to-wall dialogue. So that's an interesting sort of topic to consider. But there are still some Scott films that I haven't seen, unfortunately, like A Good Year, which, you know, that seems like one of the more notable question marks in his filmography. Romantic drama starring Russell Crowe and Marion Cotillard.
Mm-hmm. Albert Finney.
Oh, that's even better.
Yeah.
Is it good or no?
No, it's not good. But
I like,
you know,
it was a wind up. Like, yeah, no.
Well, I mean, I can lead this into my Ridley Scott answer. I'm a bit more positive than you guys on Ridley Scott. I kind of consider him to be somewhat of a William Wyler of our time, which is to say, you know, the thing about William Wyler is he was almost an anti-auteur. You know what I mean? You know, he directed The Heiress, and he also directed The Best Years of Our Lives, and he also directed, you know what I mean, he directed movies in every genre and just kind of bounced around, you know, being this really talented studio director who knew what everybody's role was on a set. And I feel like Ridley Scott has done an amazing job kind of building this like anti-auteur, you know, which unfortunately, I mean, that lends itself to people kind of almost taking him for granted and, you know, in this way kind of ignoring his output to an extent. I mean, he's gotten accolades, you know, as much as anybody else has, but I think he really is a great director. I mean, Kingdom of Heaven, his director's cut of Kingdom of Heaven is one of my all-time favorite movies, and I think it's the best movie he's ever made by a mile. So, I mean, I think,
about the director's cut, right?
The director's cut, yeah.
The director's cut of that movie, if you haven't seen it, and if you're just going off the Kingdom of Heaven you saw in theaters, like, the director's cut is a masterwork.
Truly, truly, that movie, Kingdom of Heaven, the director's cut, and I urge everybody listening to please go see it. It is, and, you know, it's
a whole different movie.
It is unbelievable. Like, if that movie comes out in theaters, Orlando Bloom is a leading man today. Like, that, you know what I mean? He is so good in that movie, and no one knows, because what they put in theaters really cuts away so much of his kind of amazingly impressive performance. And it's a shame and whatever, but the point being,
and Edward Norton too.
And Edward Norton, one of his best performances probably. Like, he is amazing in that film. Anyway,
they shortchange everyone in that movie. Like, every single person. Like, it's just incredible the way that movie transforms when you see it. Like, Ava Green's character in the theatrical release seems like a nut.
Yeah, nothing. Yeah, exactly.
And then in the full version, she is like a surprisingly strong, like, it's incredible.
I mean, I'm telling you, like, that movie, the thing, okay, so here's my point though, right? That movie, you know, is the closest you're going to, oh my God, David Lean, that's his name. That movie is the closest you're going to get to, like, a David Lean movie these days. You know what I mean? That, like that director's cut is just a sweeping, complicated epic that also has, like, the Hollywood pulp, you know, and circumstance and all that stuff. So I love when he makes movies like that, and he's made a few, you know, great films. I mean, Black Hawk Down is a great film. Blade Runner is a great film. Alien's a great film. You know, Kingdom of Heaven director's cut. I mean, in a way, Gladiator is a great film. I think it's, you know, it's a little, you know, schmaltzy and whatnot, but I mean, it's in its own way, it's a very good film. So I mean, his output is really impressive, and really he hasn't made too many bad movies. You know what I mean? I mean, if you really look at it, you know, I like a lot of his misses. I think Body of Lies is unbelievably ambitious and it does fail, but I don't know if I agree with the screenplay comment, really, because it's clear in all of his movies, maybe except for A Good Year, you know, because that just was almost that movie reads like an excuse for him to go to France with his friend Russell Crowe. And I mean, and like, if you know anything about, like, he knew the guy who wrote the book A Good Year, and he, like, told, I think his name's Peter Malays or something like that. He was like, hey man, publish this book, I'll make it into a movie. Like, they had a conversation like that, and they went and they shot it. So it's like, yeah, that's not an amazing piece of work. But even his misses, like, if you watch his Christopher Columbus movie, it is horrible. But it is like, he literally made a set that was lit only by candles, and that, you know, where Sigourney Weaver plays the queen, you know, Queen of Spain. And it's like, you're never going to see stuff like that. Like, that's, you know, like, those scenes like that, directors don't do that. You know what I mean? Like, he goes nuts, and, you know, sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And I just love that he, you know, pushes everything into these visual, you know, stylings. And I do think that starts with his picking of screenplays. And, you know, it seems like he's involved in every aspect, is my point. And even though he might not interfere, you know, as much, I think history will really show he's one of the truly diverse and great filmmakers of our time. So, and this is like The Counselor, in my mind, only kind of adds to that, you know, echelon of his weird, weird canon of kind of strangely great movies. So, yeah.
I, I'm kind of in the ambivalent camp. I have to, you know, there's some directors who I will be like, yes, I'm on board no matter what, because I feel like they do have a thematic resonance with things that I'm interested in. Ridley Scott, however, I can't know off the bat that he's going to be making something that's up my alley. I mean, as good a director as he is, and I do think he's very good, I tend to agree with what Nick said. You know, he'll take a script that he may like, but I don't know why he likes it or what he's going for. I mean, you can't look at Black Hawk Down, Matchstick Men, Robin Hood, The Counselor, and White Squall and say, Yeah, no, I get it. I understand all these films. I mean, he's not like Terrence Malick or Martin Scorsese where you figure it out. I mean, it's not a bad thing. It's just for me personally, like I don't know when I see Ridley Scott's name that I'm going to be getting the kind of movie that I'm usually into.
But isn't that in a way exciting to you though? I mean, for me it's exciting. Like I love auteurs as much as the next guy, but I love people who aren't auteurs for the same reason. You know what I mean? I mean, look, Terrence Malick's great. He's one of my favorite filmmakers, and I love that you, to an extent, kind of know what to expect in a way and whatnot. But it's great that, like, you know, all of a sudden Ridley Scott's making a political action film starring Leonardo DiCaprio, and it gets finished in a year, and then you see it. And, yeah, I mean, maybe it disappoints you, but you had no idea what it was going to be about. You know what I mean? You had no idea what to expect. And I like that he kind of can deliver surprises because he has no real directorial identity. You know what I mean? I don't know. I think that's a positive for me.
I guess that could be a positive, but I mean, you say like his lack of directorial identity is a good thing.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know that you need to tell an artist
what to do, but at the same time, for me personally, you know, I kind of need that. Also, I need to know that if he gets a bullshit script like Prometheus, that he's at least going to be able to inject something into it that'll be interesting. And unfortunately, because he just will take whatever he's got at face value and run it to completion, you know, well, he'll do it well. He'll direct whatever kind of movie he's been given on the page well, but I can't be sure that he's gonna change it in a way that's interesting to me. So it really does depend a lot on the script.
Although that is a beautifully directed film. You can say whatever you want
We talked about it. You can listen to our podcast. It is beautifully directed. At the time, it was some of the best 3D that we'd seen. It was a gorgeous film, but narratively, it's a goddamn mess, and that's a problem. So,
I mean, I'm 100% with you. You know, with Prometheus, I mean that to me is one of the biggest disappointments in his career is that movie.
Ridley Scott, to me, it's like, do you like chicken? It's like, yeah, I like chicken, but you can't just tell me I'm going to have a chicken dish, and I'm going to be all excited about it because you know, chicken will do whatever you need it to do, and if what you're making is something I'm not ready to eat, I'm not going to like that chicken.
What kind of chicken is the counselor? I'm going to say it's lemon chicken.
Makes it sound as though you don't like it.
No, it's just I have a complex relationship with lemon chicken.
Oh, okay. I'm going to say that it's kind of a stir-fried chicken.
That's interesting.
Like black beans, maybe some corn, and some diced up peppers.
I'm gonna say it's a fried chicken.
Chicken
fried chicken.
But also complete with some catfish.
This is an interesting way to segue into our discussion of The Counselor. Not only because we're talking about it already, but because here we have the element of this movie that really made me interested in it, which is we were talking about scripts and who wrote them and Ridley Scott's adherence to scripts. And this was written by Cormac McCarthy, who, as I've already said, is one of my favorite living authors. I'm rereading one of his books right now, The Crossing, second in the Border Trilogy. And I love Cormac McCarthy. I've already spoken about my affinity for The Road, the movie and the book, and all of his other stuff. Weirdly enough, Ridley Scott was going to direct an adaptation of perhaps Cormac McCarthy's best novel, Blood Meridian, but that book is so violent that there was actually, I believe, an interview he did where he said it wouldn't have been NC-17, it would have been like X-rated.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah, Todd Field tried to make it forever too.
So let's talk about the newest film by director Ridley Scott, written by Cormac McCarthy, and that is The Counselor, starring Michael Fassbender, Javier Bardem, Brad Pitt, Penelope Cruz, and Cameron Diaz.
Counselor, I always thought a law degree was a license to steal, but you for one hadn't really capitalized on it.
I don't intend to take this up as a trade.
A one-time deal, right?
Mm-hmm. You may think there are things that these people are simply incapable of. There are not. I'll try and remember that. Good.
Now, Dan, you said that you did not want to go first.
Oh, I mean, I'll go first.
I'm gonna honor that.
All right.
Let's start off with the man who wrote the review for the film stage, and that is Nick Newman.
Yeah, so I had to write the review in kind of a rush because Fox lifted their goddamn embargo early without telling me. So, you know, my thoughts on the film, although I wrote them in the review, I kind of had to get some stuff down. I feel like this is really not a film I wanted to write a quick review of because I have many thoughts on it, conflicting, complicated thoughts. I think The Counselor is maybe... I give it a B-, which to me is sort of the almost good grade. You know, I wouldn't call it a bad film, but I wouldn't necessarily call it good either. It's almost good. Okay, so here's the thing with this movie is that it's very strange, and it is very uncompromising in its strangeness, which I appreciated, certainly. You know, I think the movie getting a D in CinemaScore kind of reflects that a bit. Somewhat like another Brad Pitt crime vehicle, although he's not the driver of this supposed vehicle from last year, Killing Them Softly.
Yeah, there were a lot of people who walked out of screenings tweeting about how this was going to be this year's Killing Them Softly.
Yeah, that's correct. So there is kind of a similarity there, I suppose, in terms of what to expect and what you actually get. And yet, the movie, strangely enough, every time I think, oh man, this movie, I really appreciate how crazy it is, I kind of think back to important pieces of it, which are disappointingly ordinary, disappointingly familiar. My biggest example is probably Penelope Cruz's character, who, I mean, if you know what this film is about and I told you what her character's fate is, you would not blink an eye for a second, because you know that it's exactly where this kind of story goes. Or if I told you sort of some of the more specific pieces of it, it might sound similar and to other things, and yet the way it plays out is often so strange that I kind of have to appreciate it for that reason. But that mostly comes down to the screenplay. I was actually quite disappointed with Ridley Scott's work in this movie, which I think is very dull and very boring. Especially, I think the movie is quite ugly looking too.
Really?
I couldn't. Yeah, I don't know if it was a projection I saw, but I saw it at a press screening, which you would think looks ideal. I thought the cinematography was very flat and dull, and and not only that, but it's funny how Scott does this thing which he had done in Robin Hood, which I forgot because who remembers that stupid fucking movie?
Love that movie. Love it, guy. Watch it. We'll talk about it.
He does this thing during conversation scenes where he kind of zooms in on someone's face as they're talking, but it feels so unmotivated and it feels so unnecessary and it has no bearing on any other stylistic tics of the film that it's a small thing, but I could not stop focusing on it because I was thinking, why are you zooming your camera? Stop. Please, stop. And then the rest of the film just sort of, don't get me wrong, there are moments of inspiration, particularly scenes involving a motorcycle, which are quite nice, which feels like it takes directly from No Country for Old Men in ways, and also a rather funny scene with Brad Pitt at the end on a street, obviously you know what I'm talking about, which did remind me of No Country for Old Men, mostly because I thought to myself, Cormac McCarthy must spend a lot of time thinking of unique ways to kill people.
Yeah.
Based on the work of his I've encountered.
Researching weapons.
Coming up with weapons and just thinking of these really weird ways that someone could be killed.
He's a dark man.
Like, he's clearly a very dark man, yeah.
It's weird that you say that because I had the same thought while watching the movie. There's a point where Javier Bardem describes a bolito and he tells you what it is. And I'm just like, who would think of that, Cormac?
Yeah.
Like, is that a real thing? Like... And then I just thought about all of the books I've read of his and the various ways that he will describe someone jerry-rigging something. I mean, The Crossing involves a boy transporting a wolf from New Mexico back to Mexico after he catches it on his ranch. And I mean, like, there's long paragraphs where he's just describing, like, this kid, like, gets a stick and he's, like, making loops and all this other stuff to make a rig. And I'm like, Cormac McCarthy just sits in a room for a while and is like, this is what someone has to do. Let's think of how they do it like no one's ever done it before. And then he stares at a wall and comes up with something.
Yeah. It's gotta be. So things like that are sort of what kept me afloat, I guess. And also just the film's extremely uncompromised, initially confounding way of telling its story. The way it handles narrative incident is really fascinating. Where the most important scene in the movie, it involves a motorcycle and a unique way of killing someone. Slight spoiler alert. You actually don't realize it's the most important scene in the entire film until something like 10 or 15 minutes after it happens. The 10 or 15 minutes between that is not necessarily inconsequential either. And actually thinking back on it, like walking out, I thought, you know, what happened in that film? And then once I kind of put it together, when I realized what the film is actually about, which I'd love to discuss a bit more with you, I actually got a good laugh because I realized the thematic pull of this movie is actually rather funny. For a dark movie, the sort of what it's really about is quite humorous. So I do want to see this film again. I will say that. And I look forward to, you know, giving it a rental when it comes out on home video. Maybe it'll open up for me in new ways. But for the time being, I'm mixed, albeit in a somewhat energetic way, I guess.
Right. So, Dan Mecca, what did you think of this?
I'll kind of jump off of Nick's comment on the humor in the film. And I think, in a way, this is a Cormac McCarthy comedy. You know what I mean? I think this, in a lot of ways, is funny kind of within its darkness. And I really was a very big fan of this film. And I kind of walked away a bit shocked at how much I was with the film the entire time and how much it kind of gave me to think about when I was walking out. I mean, I think, and it is, I guess this might be contradictory to kind of the word on the street of this movie, but I look at this movie as a bunch of really talented people who got together and made exactly the type of movie and told the exact type of story they wanted to tell. And I think they did an amazing job with it. You know, to the point of the comedy, I mean, I think Brad Pitt's character is almost a gateway into the comedy of this movie, which is, you know, futility and you know, the, you know, a lot of themes of death and, you know, just the limitations of human nature and whatnot that Cormac McCarthy has kind of been writing about since he started writing. Like I imagine young Cormac McCarthy, 12 years old, killing an ant and writing a page long, you know, thesis on, you know, the life of the ants and, you know, blah, blah, blah. So I think, you know, this is a movie where I don't know how much the performances really matter. You know what I mean? I think they're more mouthpieces. You know, Michael Fassbender has given better performances than this for sure.
This is probably my least favorite performance from him outside of.
I mean, he's not given much.
Outside of Centurion, this is my least favorite performance of his.
I don't feel like there's a lot that you could criticize about it.
It's not a bad performance. Right, exactly. It's just kind of boring.
I think that's more character than.
Right. I think what I like about his character is that I like the ambivalence of his character. You know, I like that he is a man who, you know, he's not the worst person, but he's not the best person. And he kind of is in that gray area of that we probably a lot of us are in. And he, you know, makes a bad decision. And I like that it's somewhat unexplained. And I like that the movie's brave enough to do that. And I know, you know, I look at it as a positive. It is a negative. If you want more from that, I guess that it could be negative. But it tells a story we all know. We've heard it 1,000 times, but it focuses on all the parts of that story that we don't ever focus on. I don't need to see another drug movie where there's a buildup to the final deal. Like, I don't need to see another drug movie where you think maybe there's a chance they'll get away with it. You know what I mean? Like, we've seen those movies before. Like, I don't need to see those movies before, and this is not that movie. And I found it entertaining and very funny in a way that it wasn't that movie. And that's why I think I walked away so happy, because I really found every moment of entertaining. I mean, it did, you know, kind of contrary to kind of disagreeing with Nick a little bit, I found it very beautiful. I thought there were a lot of images that stuck with me. We can go into that, I guess, in spoilers. But yeah. Very, very impressed by the film, and I can't wait to see it again.
Yeah, I will say.
Oh no! I just want to say I keep telling people who ask me about it that it feels like it was written by somebody who neither watches a lot of crime films nor has much affinity for them to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, again, I think is interesting.
Yeah, so. I actually liked that because, you know, in my review that I wrote for my personal site, Dear Film, I said that, you know, we all know these kinds of films. There's like a There's an innate thing about audiences and storytellers where it's like, we like to see someone in an impossible situation thinking themselves out. We love that myth of the exceptional individual. And this is a movie that like completely decimates that idea and just, you know, says like, you know, if there's a big wheel moving and you're in its way, you can't stay in its way and get out and like make it out alive. Like, that's just what's going to happen. And I actually loved that about this film. I when I walked out of this movie at first, I was ambivalent. I was shocked. I had no idea what was going on. And then the more I thought about it, even just walking towards the subway center, I realized that I might be in love with it. And in texting a friend of mine who had gone and seen it with me, we went and saw it at a press screening together, I realized that I really, really, really quite enjoyed this film and what it was saying. And a lot of that was just about like the futility that was on display. And I loved the comedic aspect of it. It's a dark, 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 pitch black comedy that's like staring at yourself in the grave and laughing at it, because like, what else can you do? And in my review, I actually said, it's weird that you, Dan, you brought up the idea of Cormac McCarthy killing an ant and then writing about it, because I said that watching all these characters try to change their fate is both dreadful and tragically comic. It's like watching a snail attempt to outrun a car. The yeah. prospect of the gruesome death of the animal is galling, but the earnestness with which it attempts to escape is so misdirected and futile that one can't help but laugh at the wasted earnestness.
Like, right.
It's just the way it is. It's like, oh, it's trying so fucking hard, and it's not going to work. And it's kind of brutal. Like, it's a really rough, brutal movie, but
I mean it's a mean movie.
It is a mean movie because it treats all these people with all this gumption and guile and all these feelings like they can make it out, and it just shows them the uselessness and the powerlessness of it. I mean, it's just mean in the fact that like it's all these people with hopes and dreams and they all mean nothing because they've been caught up in something greater than themselves that they thought they could control, not even realizing that something they had absolutely no control over would strip them of the control that should have been theirs to have.
Whoa.
It's a bleak, dark, seminally nihilistic, but not, it's not really even nihilistic. It's just pragmatic.
Right.
It's just like, you might be going to see friends in like San Antonio and you think that everything's going to be fine. You're like, I'm on the plane. I've got my not laced up shoes so I can get through security quickly. You know, I have like all my stuff in order, but then on the way there, a duck, you know, wanders in the street, and then a semi tractor flips over and crushes your car. Like, you didn't have control over that, but that's still the world you're living in, and it's that kind of bleakness and comedy of misdirected sense of meaning. Danny King, what did you think about this film?
Well, I think all three of you have provided quite good counsel so far
nice.
In discussing this work of cinema. But yeah, I'm positive on the film. I find it interesting to think about in comparison to No Country for Old Men for obvious reasons, but I haven't read that book, but based on the film that was made, it must be a very cinematic book because there are so many stretches in that film that are just cross-cutting for 10 or 15 minutes, and there's like barely any dialogue. Whereas McCarthy's screenplay for this film could basically be a stage play in the sense that it's wall-to-wall dialogue. I mean, if you take out a lot of the brutal killings, you probably have a really good 90-minute play. And I think maybe one of the downsides is that it's almost like Ridley Scott he's deferring to the script so much that it's like he's not even directing it in a sense. I wasn't too engaged by what he was doing. Even some of the dialogue scenes where you want the actors to be the center of the scene and you want to listen to the dialogue, I felt he could have maybe done something more. And I do agree with Nick that the film looks kind of gray and just sort of dull. But again, that could have been the projection. But overall, I did.
He shot it on the red, which always kind of has mixed results. And you can sort of detect that at times. There are these, I say this in the worst sense, there are Soderbergh-ian sort of impositions of light, I guess. Sometimes you have scenes where like a light is coming through a window. It has sort of that smeary, dull look, which kind of permeates a lot of the movie's imagery for me. Mm. So, you know.
But yeah, I overall did like the movie. And I found it, you know, pretty fascinating just to watch this cast of actors sort of struggle and work through the dialogue they were given. Because there are times where it's like, I think maybe Javier Bardem and Brad Pitt are the ones who sort of own their characters completely. And I think they're kind of like they're the ones who you feel they're sort of in control of every line they're saying. With the other actors, there are kind of moments where it's like they're not sure how to play a line or they don't seem confident enough. And I think that's almost interesting too, because it is like McCarthy is absolutely the driving force of the film. But you want to know this going in. Obviously, that's reflected in like the D cinema score and the fact that the movie will probably make no money. I mean, I know I took a look at the script before watching it, and when all I saw was blocks of dialogue, you know, I got pretty excited because I knew sort of what I was getting into. But if you watch that trailer and go see the film, you're probably not going to get what you want. It's a different beast.
Yeah.
And what about the performances? I guarantee you, Cameron Diaz will never play a harder character in her life.
For sure. Yeah,
you know, and look, I don't know. I can't say she did a good job in this film, but I'll say this. What I will say about Cameron Diaz's performance is that it's a really good try to play a character who's barely human. You know what I mean? I felt her character was without a doubt the most difficult to crack and on purpose, right? And she, you know, is, you know, without spoiling anything, there are layers and she has a lot of very long line, you know, kind of long lines that are kind of enigmatic in that Cormac McCarthy way. And I don't even know if another actress could have done a better job. I mean, Angelina Jolie, I guess, was supposed to play this role initially, so I am curious what she could have delivered, but so.
Yeah, I think just to say one more line that sort of stuck in my head, there's a scene between Javier Bardem and Michael Fassbender where I think like one of the first lines of the scene is Javier Bardem saying something like, "What do you think about women?" or just something incredibly broad and generic, but right when he says it, you know the point of that whole scene is going to be him talking about women. And it's just like a really cool feeling watching that, because it's like Cormac McCarthy is basically writing a whole scene telling this guy what to say about women, and we're watching it, and it's probably going to piss a lot of people off, but it's actually quite fascinating to listen to.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I mean, I also, you know, think the kind of, you know, the introduction of, you know, misogyny, quote unquote, in the beginning of the film really works nicely into how the rest of the film plays out. And I think there's a lot of that in the movie. You know, I think for people saying this is a poorly written screenplay by McCarthy, I mean, I just think they're wrong. I think they're dead wrong. You know, I think this is a very layered and really interesting piece of writing.
Yeah,
you know?
This movie is dense.
Like, yeah,
I need to see it again just to, because it's not
very simple. It's very, very simple at its core, but also there's a lot happening that, you know.
Yeah,
the ideas
it's exploring are pretty straightforward, but the way in which the dialogue is weaved together and the different scenes interact with and inform one another is dense. Like, I need to see it again. I need to get my hands on the script, and I need to just like go through line by line.
I can send you an old PDF file.
I already have it. I was trying to make it seem as though I didn't.
Oh, okay. Well, who cares?
Yeah, and I mean, Cameron Diaz, like, I mean, her character is the classic, like, Judge Holden, Anton Chigurh, like, style Cormac McCarthy villain. Like, the otherworldly creature that exerts its power over all around it through sheer force of will. And, I mean, in her is the heart of the story that it's trying to tell. Like, she's the only one who really gets the situation that they're in and has the guile and the coldness to pull off what everyone else is attempting to pull off. Like, she's the only one willing to sacrifice of herself in order to get what she wants out of this cesspool that everyone's trying to pull from.
Oh, we're getting a little spoilery here.
I didn't say that she succeeded. I'm just saying she did.
Yeah, we should probably just go in.
I was about to say, though, we should jump into spoilers now, now that we've got our general feelings out.
Let's jump on it.
Let's jump on it. Let's jump into that cesspool of spoilers. So the way that the film works is, and this is the other thing I kind of liked about the film, even thinking back on it, I'm not 100% sure what Michael Fassbender's role in this criminal enterprise was.
He's a newcomer.
I was under the impression he got them a bunch of money and then
he was facilitating in some way the initial investment that would then get more money. And the assumption is, and he gets this contact by first meeting a character played by Rosie Perez in a strange cameo that I did not see coming.
Good scene, though. I like that.
Yeah, that was a really good scene.
what was it? It's like, oh, shit. Fuck, what was the initial amount of money? It was like, you know,
$400
and then she's like, or I could give you a blowjob, and he's like, you'd still owe me $380.
Come on, love that.
Oh my god. The theater I was in, like, some people weren't into it, but that made everyone erupt.
That woke half of my audience up, and then they fell back.
Yeah, there was a guy next to me who was literally, like, he spent the first two scenes laughing at inappropriate times. And then
there was a lovely woman next to me who snored the entire time. I swear.
Like, I go to a press screen like that, and I want to ask for, like, cards afterwards. Like, I want to mark people out and just be like, hey, you know, I'm a critic too. Like, let's exchange information. So then I can just tweet out, like, this motherfucker, if he writes a review on The Counselor, is a Christ forsaken liar.
There's sort of an idea where, like, maybe this would be a good film to be asleep during and then review.
That was
a joke.
There's a school of thought that believes that you can only truly review a movie if you sleep through it. But anyway, so what happens is he has to get her son out of prison because he was speeding.
And well, it doesn't have to.
Well, I mean, he says he will. So he just after that, does he does. So he gets the son out. And that's like his only interaction with the son, who's a link in the chain of this drug thing. And then the son is killed so that a rival group can get the drugs. And the assumption is that because he had even the barest amount of involvement with the son and knew about the son, that he turned on the cartel.
Right.
Which is wrong. What's true is that Cameron Diaz is like bugging the shit out of, like, in a wiretapping sense, Javier Bardem's character Rainier. And she's like pulling the strings to try to get the drugs for herself, which is crazy because then the other thing that happens is that the cartel gets the drugs back and the rest of the transport goes without a hitch. So the best and most hilarious part of this movie is you always see a movie where like the drug deal goes bad and then someone has to pay. And in this one, it's like, yeah, someone has to pay, but we're still getting it done. You know,
yeah, of course,
like the drugs make it to where they're supposed to go. We still get our money. But principles dictate that you guys have to die horribly.
Well, as I had said, may I speak as to what I think the movie is really about?
Absolutely, yes. We're in spoilers. I think
it's a strangely feminist movie. I think it's a very funny. It's very funny to think this is a movie about a woman who fucks with a bunch of men. Right. Almost at times, it feels like because she can, and because she sort of relishes having that power over a. You know, so much of the film is about dominance. I think it's as indicated by the cheetahs, which they're raising, which they kind of have for no reason other than them being sort of like this imposing, graceful figure. And I suppose with her tattoos and whatnot, Malkina.
Malkina.
fantastic Al-Qaeda name. Is something of a she's something of a cheetah herself, right? And so basically, it's about a woman who fucks with a bunch of men, and the thing is, you know, they never suspect her for various reasons, mostly because you would not really think a woman is capable of doing that. And what's funny is that the movie actually really clearly illustrates that she's up to something when she's listening in on them.
Yeah.
And the movie makes a point of showing her listening in, but you kind of, I didn't think to myself, oh yeah, she's totally in on this. I kind of fell under the movie's spell a bit, where I thought to myself, oh no, it's just like, you know, it's
that's just what people,
some people.
In a Cormac McCarthy world, people listen in on other people.
Yeah, I just thought because she was sort of a, you know, she's sort of a controlling sort. She wants to be on the inside, but I didn't, you know, I underestimated her and her role in this. And I have to wonder if I would have felt the same way if it was a male protagonist doing that. So this movie exposes me to be a terrible sexist.
Yeah,
so good on you, Cormac.
And the other crazy thing is just the way that they have her, you know, manipulating her sexuality to like basically destroy this guy. Like,
I can't imagine what scene might come to mind when you relate this character's sexuality. What scene in this movie involves her sexuality? Oh, that's right.
She's in the confessional booth.
Yes.
What I love about this scene, what I love about the now already infamous car fucking scene,
When he said, like, there are things that I wish that I could forget, and then Michael Fassbender is like, "What do you wish you could forget?" He's like, "I wish I could forget Malkina fucking my car." Like, that is some great acting from Michael Fassbender. Because he's like, it's legitimately like, what the fuck are you talking about?
I mean, what I like, though, about that scene is that is one of the most interesting ways to foreshadow I've ever seen in a movie. Right? Because literally the whole thing is, you know, Javier Bardem, you know, it starts as somewhat of a joke, but then at the end, it's like, no, it scared me because I don't know who this person is. Like, she cares. She's so obsessed with the power and the greed, and literally, like, she fucks a Ferrari because the Ferrari is powerful to her.
Yeah.
You know, like, what I mean?
That's
I think that is kind of fascinating. And in, as to the cheetahs, you know, for all the cheetah haters out there, let us remember, okay, that cheetahs, are one of the greatest jungle hunters in the world, whatever. But in real life, the whole thing with them is they are one of the fastest animals. But once they run really fast for like the 10 seconds, they can't run for like an hour. And they actually get caught quickly. You know what I mean? Because like they have like a burst of energy, but they're like their span of dominance is short, which I think is somewhat intentional to like the idea of this world that we're in, you know, kind of these lives that are being lived are rather short. I don't know. But I thought I was thinking about it during the movie, and I feel like there's something there.
She follows that too, because her moment of actual action in the movie is very brief, like the end of the third act.
Right.
Like for a while, she's kind of
She's going to go down too. You know what I mean? Like that's the whole thing.
And she
about
knows that. Like she says, "Well, I can never go back to Mexico or America, so I have to go to one of these other places." Like she understands that she's now created a dangerous situation for herself. And no one else in the movie seems to get that. They have that feeling like, I can work my way out of this. I can
do
this.
Exactly.
And
yeah.
She realizes those places are dead to me. I've made my money and now I've got to go somewhere else to enjoy it. And she even tells her banker to get the hell out.
Go ahead. I was going to say, and just to kind of put the imagery that I was speaking to earlier is the scene where you watch that like go through after everything that's happened and after the shootout and after people have been killed. I love about the scene is it just really emphasizes to you guys, this, like, the drugs are the only things that matter. Like, the drug lords don't matter. The middlemen like Brad Pitt and Javier Bardem don't matter. The shitty lawyers like Michael Fassbender don't matter. Like, it's literally only about the product. It'll always only be about the product. Nothing matters. People don't matter. It's all about what you're selling and how you're selling it. You know, I love that cyclical nature of capitalism. I mean, that's, to me, that was like really, really interesting, you know, and I thought it was funny. That's like a punchline in a way. You know, it's like there's like a shootout where like four people die and they die badly. And then it's like drugs, still going around.
Yeah, the guy just gets in the car and he's like, time to go.
Yeah, I mean, like the nobility of traffic is just like thrown out the window.
Yeah, no, I loved the way that it was like, this is the big machine that's going to keep on moving. And then the most comical element is there's a fourth barrel that's not filled with drugs. It's just filled in a dead guy.
Dean Norris
from Breaking Bad is like, why is there a dead guy in that thing? And they're like, oh, it's like a joke the cartel has. They just ship him around. You know, it goes from place to place. It's like, oh, what's in this? Oh, it's a dead guy. All right, put him back in the car. We'll just send him some.
You guys.
Because that's what life means to them. It means nothing. It is a commodity which they can use however they desire.
Right.
And it's like, you know, you may think like, oh, you know, it's not my fault. Well, it doesn't fucking matter if it's your fault. Like, this is just how it is. You know, a spark plug. If you think the spark plug isn't hitting, you're going to throw out the spark plug and put a new one in. It might be a problem with the carburetor. But you're going to change that spark plug if that's what you think the problem is, because you don't give a shit about that spark plug's feelings. The machine must keep running, and that's how it's going to run.
Exactly.
I legitimately love this movie.
I got to go fix my car.
All right. Can I bring down the temperature here?
Bring it down, bro. Bring it down.
Bring it to a simmer.
So again, you know, there are fascinating elements of this movie, but... It's because of those that the more ordinary aspects ring all the more disappointingly. I think of there's a very, very bad scene in the third act when Michael Fassbender basically finds out that all has gone to hell, and he's sitting in his car and he's like weeping. And there's the score in this movie is terrible, by the way. The score by Daniel Pemberton.
No, it's a terrible score. No,
and it's at its worst in that scene when he's screaming like "Damn you!" and whatnot. And I've never really felt embarrassed for Michael Fassbender, but there I felt embarrassed for him. I thought it was a really bad scene, and I couldn't believe Cormac McCarthy wrote it. I could sort of believe that Ridley Scott directed it. And that was the moment where the movie pretty much lost me, as this guy is just droning on and on and on and on about the same point over the course of that one scene.
Ruben Blades. That's his name. All right.
Ruben Blades. Yes. Okay. I'm just thinking to myself. I was almost thinking to Cormac McCarthy. I was thinking, what the fuck are you talking about, old man? Like, what are you saying? Like, shut up, please.
It's very clear what he's saying.
No, I mean, it is. But
Nick, I have to disagree with you about that speech, because I thought it was one of the strongest points in parts of the movie. I really feel like it's a little long-winded, but I kind of love what he had to say. I mean, I feel like, why would you? I felt like, as someone who's read a bit of Cormac McCarthy, that was to be expected, and I enjoyed every minute of it. And I thought it was a nice little soliloquy, kind of that just ties the whole point of the movie together. So,
right. But also, as I said in my review, I was kind of disappointed that when McCarthy's dialogue, which is so specific and kind of, it kind of feels like it's being spoken almost by people who are already dead in a way when you read it on the page. Did not really translate to the screen for me. It just kind of felt like dialogue, albeit well-written, interesting dialogue filled with almost affably obvious foreshadowing, which I kind of liked. I like that doom hangs over this entire film.
Yeah, the sword of Damocles is just like hanging there over every single character.
Yes.
I love that about it. I love that weariness. I love that knowingness. And watching these people with this energy just getting taken down. And the best part is that, I mean, one of my favorite things is, like, Rainier in the movie isn't supposed to die. Like, they very clearly state a couple times, we need him alive.
Mm-hmm.
And so you almost allow yourself to feel a little safe about that. okay, they're not going to kill Javier Bardem. He's going to live. And then they shoot him in the face.
Right, and
the guy's just like, we weren't supposed to kill him. Okay, well, fuck it.
And there's still a decent amount of movie left. He dies, which is interesting. But when it's spoken, it kind of feels like dialogue. It doesn't have that same thing. And I actually went and I was reading some of the screenplay. What's interesting is that they actually changed the screenplay a bit when it came to the film. I wonder if McCarthy did that himself, but... It was actually, it seemed even stranger on page. So I'd be curious to see, read the whole thing, and make that comparison. But even then, as it is here, it didn't feel exactly quite right. And I guess I was thinking of, again, I keep going back to No Country for Old Men, which I feel like is a fair comparison because they are similar-ish. There are enough similarities to warrant the comparison. That movie is so much more tightly directed, and the acting in it is much more precise and much less, much more, I guess, specific and cohesive. Here, it was a little too varied, and yeah.
And I think a big difference, and this goes to kind of, I think this speaks to the audience enjoyment value of it as well, is the comedy is a lot more obvious. And I mean, it is a comedy. I don't mean like a more obvious, like a detriment, but in No Country, the comedy, like the laughing points are a little bit more clear, which I think helps that movie a lot as well.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Does Danny have any final thoughts before we wrap this up?
Let's see. Well, yeah, I was comparing it to No Country earlier, which is just, I mean, yeah, it's a much better directed film, but it's also, like I said, much more kind of inherently cinematic. I feel like this is just a really tough assignment for a director. But, you know, thankfully the writing for me was good enough that it didn't really kill the movie for me.
I'm just going to put this out there. I don't know if anyone's brought this up yet, but I also wonder if the movie would have been a little bit different if Ridley Scott didn't deal with kind of, you know, really sad things that happened last year.
Mm-hmm.
With his brother.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I was wondering about that as kind of, you know, if you're dealing with a situation like that, does that affect your attention you're giving to a very difficult movie like this?
Yeah, I was wondering about that a little bit.
Mm-hmm. I guess we'll never know, but it's something that is definitely kind of in the back of my mind while watching it. Also, one more quick thing. Brad Pitt loves the subject of the human futility, because the Mexican, Killing Them Softly, and this movie are all essentially about like this, that similar idea. Just like people doing things that are dangerous, and there's really no way to escape it.
Brad Pitt, who has a great death scene in this movie.
Oh, yeah.
When you hear the story of the Bolito, you're wondering who's going to get the Bolito.
Yeah. I thought the movie was going to end on Michael Fassbender getting the Bolito, and I was so happy when it was not that.
Yeah.
Mr. Pitt.
You talk about the comedy of this movie. I found, again, as I said before, I actually found Brad Pitt's death scene kind of funny because he's not even really scared that he's going to die.
He's almost pissed.
Well, I was going to say, he's like irritated that he has to deal with this.
He almost, at the end,
just screaming like,
fuck you!
Fuck you!
Because at that point, he's like, all right, I'm dead, but now I just have to be pissed off about it. And he's even more pissed because his hand is caught.
Mm-hmm.
And so he takes one of the hands out. He's like, all right, I just need to get free of this so this can just happen. But instead, he ends up prolonging his exposure and death by trying to stop it. And then he gets his fingers cut off, and then finally the prophecy that was laid by Rainier is fulfilled when blood sprays out over the spectators. This is the last thing I'll talk about before we move on, because I know we're on a deadline here. Bruno Ganz is in this film, and he has a scene as a diamond dealer.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a great line there where it says, like, it's the flaws that make the diamond valuable, because if there were no flaws, it would just be light.
Yeah, that's a really interesting scene, I think, actually.
Yeah. And there's, again, I feel like every scene in this movie holds the key to all the other scenes in this movie, and that's one of them that I feel like isn't getting a lot of play out in the world, and so I just wanted to bring it up that not only does it do a good job of kind of foreshadowing the cravenness of Malkina later, where she's able to rattle off all the same stats that we were told in a very long sequence with a guy with a, you know, a jeweler's round in his eye by just looking at the damn ring. But he has some very salient points about what makes something valuable and what you see in things. So that's The Counselor, our various thoughts on this. This is a movie that has gendered a lot of discussion, and it's the most we can hope for a film. So go out. It's in theaters now. I say check it out.
Definitely. Go see it.
Yeah.
I mean, in a world of Man of Steels, go see The Counselor. Like, yeah, I mean, it's a different movie. Whatever. Go see it. It's better than 90. You know what I mean? You know what I mean. You get me. Come on.
I got you, man.
In the world of Bad Grandpa, go see The Counselor.
Bad Grandpa, I mean? Which did beat The Counselor today.
And I did see, and I did like as well. I'm just saying, I'm just merely pointing out that, you know, The Counselor is different, and you should go see that.
Okay. Well, let's rattle through everything that's coming out real quick so we can be on our way. Coming out to DVD and Blu-ray on October 29th, we have Monsters University, R.I.P.D.
No. Oh.
Byzantium.
Dude. Byzantium. Okay, Byzantium. Yeah.
Yeah. And then that seems like it's it for the new ones. We have some re-releases. We have a Blu-ray of La Notte. Yeah, I'm going to say that I never saw Monsters University, but I did see Byzantium, and I absolutely love that film. So you should check that out, because I'm sure that you haven't seen it yet.
I recently rewatched Interview with the Vampire, so that counts.
Well, that, sure.
I mean, it's close. I feel like it's close.
Did anyone see Byzantium?
No.
Nah.
I really want to see it though.
Yeah, it was fantastic. It's a beautiful movie. It kind of restores honor to the concept of the vampire. There's a little bit of weirdness towards the end, but it lays into it. And you know, talking about feminist movies, that's a very feminist movie. So you know. Mm-hmm. Anyway, anyone see R.I.P.D.?
Oh, dude, I saw that movie.
How bad was
really?
It?
Really?
It's,
oh, wait, did you review it?
I wrote the review, yeah. I think I gave it a C. It's not, it's certainly not that bad. It's just, you know, it's a recycled movie. It's 90 minutes of Men in Black meets, you know, 48 hours. You know, a buddy cop movie. You know, it's like, there's just nothing original about it, and it's just, you know, Jeff Bridges gives a truly awful performance. And, I mean, you know, what are you going to do? That's the movie.
So the lesson here is get the Criterion Blu-ray of La Notte, obviously.
Yeah, get that.
Check out Byzantium.
Or Byzantium.
It looks like Peter Weir's Fearless is also...
That's a good one.
Getting Blu-ray release. That's a much better, I imagine, Jeff Bridges' performance. I haven't seen R.I.P.D. Fearless also has... Yeah, it's a great performance. And Fearless also has Rosie Perez...
That's like an oddly, like a lot of Peter Weir's movies, that's like an oddly forgotten, very good movie.
All right.
Yeah, I actually saw it a couple months ago.
Yeah.
So coming out to theaters November 1st, we have the expansion of 12 Years a Slave, which we will be talking about next week. Also coming out, which you could check out, I guess, if you felt the need to, Ender's Game, the newest film by Gavin Hood. This stars Asa Butterfield, Harrison Ford, and a couple of other people. Last Vegas, which is Robert De Niro, Michael Douglas, Morgan Freeman, and
yeah,
Kevin
boy,
by the director of National Treasure.
And National Treasure 2, Book of Secrets.
Yes.
Don't forget.
And Phenomenon.
And Three Ninjas.
Oh, God.
Rocky loves you, dude, forever.
Hell yeah. We also have the animated film Free Birds, starring Owen Wilson, Woody Harrelson. About
produced.
Time. Wait, produced by what?
Produced by Kevin Smith's producer, Scott Mosier.
Oh, well, that's a thing. Yeah. About Time, starring Domhnall Gleeson and Rachel McAdams, which has the most generic goddamn romance poster ever. It's like...
Nick, you were talking earlier about how I was going to be a sucker for Las Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
I will also be a sucker for About Time, for
sure. I'm going to read the summary for this. At age 21... Tim discovers he can travel in time and change what happens and has happened in his own life. His decision to make his world a better place by getting a girlfriend turns out to be not as easy as you might think.
What? Crazy.
Okay. I mean, I liked Domhnall Gleeson in Anna Karenina and Dread. Did everyone here see Dread?
Yeah, Dread's good.
Guys, see Dread. It's amazing. I don't know how I feel about it.
Amazing, this. I feel like it's strong. But it's
an action film, it's amazing. We also have The Dallas Buyers Club, which is another of the Matthew McConaughey resurgence films. And a movie called Diana that stars Naomi Watts as Princess Diana.
5% right now.
Yeah, I was about to say, you haven't heard of this for a reason, I'm presuming.
Holding strong at 5%.
I've already seen 12 Years a Slave, but that's still the movie that I want to see the most out of all of these. Any other thoughts on these before we get to the random recommendations?
I think I will say, look, if you like The Bucket List, and I'm not trying to be like, I'm not trying to be snarky, but seriously, if you like The Bucket List and you like, you know, those movies, which is awesome, I like them, you'll love Las Vegas. I'm sure you'll love Las Vegas. You know what I mean? I think it's going to be actually pretty funny. So,
the Las Vegas trailer has one of the most stunning moments in film I've seen this year. Robert De Niro says a line to someone where he's like, nobody calls us names except for us. Yeah. And in the middle of the line, it flashes back to what I guess are like the younger versions of them, and the younger version finishes the line.
My hope is that that's like a motif throughout the film.
Yeah, like just in the middle of scenes.
Every 10 minutes, he's just like, what did you call me? And then it like cuts back for like 70 years, and he's like, I called you a jerk. Like, I cannot wait.
All right. Okay, so let's talk about random recommendations. It's something we watched briefly, guys. Briefly. Danny King, briefly. What's something that you watched on your own that you think
Should I just say the title?
Say the title and like a tweet-sized thoughts on it.
Okay. On Netflix Instant, I watched Robert Aldrich's 1955 film, The Big Knife, which is adapted from a stage play. Also very talky film, but it really cuts to a lot of interesting issues about the movie industry and leaves a devastating punch.
All right, excellent. Nick Newman, what about yourself?
Also a Netflix watch instantly. I would say The Big Knife. I can imagine a poster with Edward G. Robinson on it.
Like
a detective or something.
Yeah, unfortunately.
That'd be a good listicle thing, like posters where Edward G. Robinson plays a detective and he kind of has that scowl on his face, that suspicious scowl. Everybody here can picture it. Everybody listening hopefully can picture it. Anyway, also on Netflix watch recently, I watched King of New York, an Abel Ferrara movie from 1990.
Oh, I watched that recently.
That's a good one.
Okay. Starring Christopher Walken. I've been meaning to see more Ferrara. I really should. And this was available, so I thought it was Saturday morning. I thought, yeah, let's do it. Really, really, really good film.
Yeah, very good. Yeah.
Beautifully directed. I was really, not knowing much about Ferrara, I guess I was more liable to be surprised than a big fan of his would be. But some really incredible filmmaking going on here. And a good crime tale, too. A very there's something about the movie's darkness, which I really appreciated, that he does craft a sympathetic character out of the Christopher Walken protagonist, who is nevertheless an absolute monster. Very strong. I would recommend seeing it. Also for an amazing Lawrence Fishburne performance, too. So, there's that.
All right, excellent. Mecca.
I'm going to jump off of Danny King, talking about the industry, and I recently watched Vincent Minnelli's The Bad and the Beautiful, starring Kirk Douglas. It's a great, great, great movie about a Hollywood producer, and Kurt Douglas gives one of the best performances of his career, and Minnelli directed it, so obviously it's very beautiful. You should go watch it. Hashtag great. Tweet size.
Hashtag great. And it's Halloween on Netflix Instant, Ghostbusters.
Oh, Ghostbusters? Yeah, that's your go-to, huh? Okay.
I mean...
I get it, dude. I gotta rewatch Ghostbusters. I gotta get back into it. Cool, yeah. Ghostbusters.
Anyway, Ghostbusters is great. I also saw the Rocky Horror Picture Show, and I've seen that a few times, and I still don't fucking get it. I'll never understand the fucking appeal to that, or how it got made in the first place. But you know, it's out there. It's a camp classic, whatever.
I think it got made with like a camera, and probably some actors and filmmakers.
Nice. Wait, actually, speaking of Tim Curry and Halloween movies, what's that movie he made in the 80s, like The Worst Witch? You know what I'm talking about? Where he plays the witch. You guys know what I'm talking about?
I thought you were going to say Congo for a second.
He plays the Witch King. Oh,
sounds great.
Okay, that sounds perfect. Everyone look up that movie. But that's it for today. We'll be talking about 12 Years a Slave next week. Newest film by one of my favorite directors currently working, Steve McQueen. He directed Shame and Hunger. Also stars Chiwetel Ejiofor, Michael Fassbender, and Brad Pitt. So make of that what you will. Let's say where we can be found online. Guests first. Dan, where can we find you online?
You can find me at thefilmstage.com or my Twitter handle, DJ Mecca. And it's called The Worst Witch. It's called The Worst Witch, by the way.
In the house.
So. Yes, yes.
Anyway, Danny King, what about yourself?
Filmstage.com, personal site, thekingbulletin.com, and twitter.com/thekingbulletin.
And Nick Newman.
Thefilmstage.com and twitter.com/Nick_Newman.
And you can find me on twitter.com/BrianJRowan, as well as thefilmstage.com and my personal site, dearfilm.net. So ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us, and tune in next week.